Well, let's start. Welcome. Thanks for being there up to the end of the lecture. Today, as announced, I was fortunate to be able to do what I planned. I'm going to come back to gauge theories and discuss renormalization. Well, briefly, very briefly, because we have just 1 hour, ask some various aspects of the renormalization. Non-abelian gauge series, so Young-Mills series. Okay, so of course that's a very important subject in quantum field theory in high energy physics, because the reason why non-abelian gauge theory is important in physics is first they describe the quark interaction, but also because they are the only known consistent quantum field theory in four dimensions, well, up to some supersymmetric extension. Because they have the property of asymptotic freedom that we discussed very briefly, well, too briefly. So I'm first going to discuss some aspects of perturbative or normalization, and then go back to the non-perturbative aspects. You have seen that the Young-Mills theory are given by an action, which is basically in four dimensions. Well, have some factors that show you have a trace of F mu, and then you have the, you must add to this the ghost gauge fixing term in order to be consistent. So you have ghost fields and dimensionally, F mu is obtained from the gauge field A mu. By dimensional analysis, well, it's g squared is the charge of the gauge field, and dimensionally, the dimension of A in let's call it A in energies is one, in momentum, so inverse of distances. Which means that dimension of F mu is two, and therefore this action is dimensionless. So G is dimensionless. The coupling constant G squared, the dimension of G squared is zero. So how did we start with A mu as dimension? Usually we start, we fix the dimension of the field based on the kinetic term, but now the kinetic term also has a coupling. Well, here that's the definition where A, you see that the coupling is there. So F mu is just d mu a nu minus d mu a mu minus i a mu a nu. So you have no, the structure constant of the algebra do not contain any coupling constant, which So when you do perturbation theory, you multiply, you change, you write that A is G times the things that you compute. So no, it doesn't change the dimension, no. So I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood your question.
Usually when we, if we line the scalar field action, there is d mu phi, which is, and then there is d 4x. So we know, we fix the dimension of phi because we know the whole action should be dimensionless. But now we also have a coupling in front, which we don't know anything about.
Yeah, but no, but you see that the action has to be dimensionless. Yeah. So of course, x has to be, must have to dimension minus one. So in four dimension, G squared is zero. If you are in a dimension, if you define a gauge theory in three dimension or in five dimension, then the coupling constant is not, the dimension of the coupling is not zero. So it's a different issue. But the fact that the coupling is zero means that you can expect a normalizability. But of course, in order to prove that this gauge theories are renormalizable, it's a much more difficult task because you have to be ensured that gauge invariance, which is essential, is preserved by the procedure of renormalization. So in fact, it was a big issue in the 60s and I was still younger than you. But it was, you know, the breakthrough occurred in the beginning of the 70s, when people showed that this was, yes?
Yeah, you can say something like, you know, because here we sum Romu, Nu, with Nu, Nu. So this means Romu should have same dimension as Nu, right?
Yeah, of course, they must have same dimension. But they must have the same dimensions as the derivative. Yeah, D, that's what you said, d mu or mu? I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Yeah, d mu must have the same dimension of mu in order for this to be consistent. Yeah. So this is always the case. This has to be the case, independently of the dimension. So the dimension of the field here is independent on the on space. This has, it's different from phi 4. You can also see that because, in fact, the real object, which is a geometrical object, if you view a gauge theory as a theory of connection on a bundle of gauge bundle over space-time, the real object is A, which is A mu dx mu. This has to be dimensionless. So this is, for a mathematician, what's often called a form, a one form, which defines the connection. So this has to be dimensionless. Okay. Okay. So, of course, well, renormalization had to be dealt with by showing that you can renormalize all the divergences which were there in a consistent way which preserved gauge invariant. And this was a non-trivial issue because, for instance, if you consider the propagator, you need a two-point function, you get diagrams like that. I'm not going to do any very detailed calculation. And then you have the minus the gauge, the contribution of the gauge, of the ghosts. Okay. And remember, you have the four vertices, the three vertices. The three vertices carry a derivative of the momenta of one of the gauge fields. So, you know, this is carry some p mu, while this times g, while this carries some just b squared. So you see that if you have to be careful to do this calculation with the proper rules, and the ghosts are very important. These are the ghost loop. Because you see, if you have, for instance, one momentum here and one momentum here, you have the propagator is 1/p² for the gauge. So this is behaved like 1/p², but you have 1/p², 1/p², but you can have a p and a p here. And here, which gives a d^4p/p², which is divergence. So you may have lambda squared divergence if you have some cutoff, if lambda is some cutoff, plus some log of lambda. Well, here, this is a tadpole, so you get a lambda squared. And for the ghost also, well, the ghost, it's okay. The ghost carry a momentum of, no, the ghost carry also a momentum. The ghost vertex carries also momentum p, where you have some of the momentum. So this also can have the lambda squared plus log lambda. So the first calculation to do is to check that those lambda factors cancel, and they do. If you had a lambda squared mass term, this would mean that the mass of the gauge field, which has to be massless, or if you want to preserve gauge invariance, the gauge field would become massive. So you have to check that this disappears, and then you get a renormalization with logs, a divergence with logs. So this you can absorb them into renormalization of the mass. So if you have a log of lambda, if you have some g² log lambda, you expect that you can absorb this. Well, no, this is a two-point function. So for the two-point function, if you have a g² log lambda, you can absorb this into a renormalization of the field A. But you have to check that this definition is a renormalization of the wave function of the field, that's like a wave function normalization, has to be consistent if you consider the three-point function. because you have this, and then you have a lot of loops diagrams. You have to check plus a lot of loops diagrams, and you have to check that the lambda squared term disappears too, that you have a log lambda, and the log lambda can be absorbed by a consistent term. There should be a relation between the two. Because you see, the gauge, the three gluon coupling come from the fact that you have, when you take f mu nu squared, it comes from this commutator of a mu with d mu. And so the factor has to be right in order to preserve the position. Okay, and the same for the four-point function. So in fact, you have to check that the lambda squared disappears, so that gauge invariance, the gauge field doesn't become massive. And in addition, that all the possible coefficients that appear in the divergence of the various diagrams, you know, when you compute the divergence of the two-point function, of the three-point function, of the four-point function, and also the divergence of the Gauss, you have to preserve consistency. Consistency. So, well, this has been achieved in the 70s, beginning with the 70s. Well, the first famous calculation was done by Toft and Veltman, who showed, in fact, that you can use a gauge regularization model, which instead of a lambda, instead of a cutoff lambda, go to what's called dimensional regularization. So do the calculation in a dimension D, which is 4 minus epsilon. Well, so the same kind of trick that is used in study of critical phenomena, which is called dimensional regularization, which makes sense in perturbation theory, and which preserve gauge invariance. Can check that if you make this trick in the calculation, each time that you have a contraction of g mu mu instead of the dimension of space-time, 4 minus epsilon, the integrals becomes finite, and the Ward identities of the theory are preserved. So this dimensional regularization preserves gauge invariance. Then the trick is that when the log lambda are replaced by pole in epsilon, and therefore a procedure of renormalization amounts to introduce counter terms containing poles in epsilon. Okay. So this was one of the breakthroughs. I was a student, I think. Very young student when this appears, but that was very new when I started to do theoretical physics, so that stopped. And then, you know, various teams generalized the method and established that at all order in perturbation theory, gauge theories were renormalizable, either by writing properly, using properly the Ward identity of gauge theories, or by using these BRST symmetries that I showed you a few lectures ago for the method. Okay, so this is now an established fact, but I would like to present very briefly another method to study renormalization at one loop, because it's important in other contexts that you are going to meet, which is called the gauge fixing. What is it written here? It's called the background gauge fixing method. Yes?
Briefly, because you mentioned word identities.
Word identities, or yes.
And if I remember correctly, that was about the polarizations.
Yes, they have to deal with the polarizations. That's basically, I won't have time. I have no notes very well prepared, but it's well explained, for instance, in the Peskin. But word identity means that you have, when you have an element that's asymmetric or whatever, when if you have a Boolean momentum with momentum K mu, when you contract with K, this has to be zero. So it's a K mu something with an index mu here, has to be zero. It's well, the origin is exactly the same than in QED, where I think you have seen the word identity. They take a more complicated form in a bit more complicated in Young-Mills. They are called word Takahashi identities. I don't want to talk about that, but it's an extension to non-abelian gauge series of something which is known in QED. Okay, but I'm going to discuss something else briefly, but I think because it's illuminating, so I won't go through all the calculation, but I think it's important to the philosophy. Okay, so the idea is that you want to compute at one loop an object which is the effective action of a gauge field, which is defined exactly in the same way as what we did, for instance, for the 5-4 theory or theory with boson. So we want to define an effective action, okay, for now this is a background field. So this is something, let's call it A bar, which is a classical background field. Okay, and there is a well-defined method to study that, which is the following. Okay, we start from the action here, but with a gauge fixing term. We want to enforce a gauge fixing term in the, for instance, in the functional integral. And instead of taking, for instance, a Landau Feynman gauge, d mu, a mu equals some constant or zero or some psi, that's a Landau Feynman gauge. I'm using very compact notation, so in fact, this contains the color indices. Mu is something like MuATA, where TA are the generator of the gate of the algebra. Okay. So instead of having this Landau gauge, given A, given some classical background, Mu, classical, here. I want to define for a general gauge field. I'm going to do the following trick. First, in the functional integral, I write A as E mu, the classical background, plus some quantum fluctuation term. So I write A mu equal A bar mu. So this is fixed, and this is a quantum part. I'm going to integrate. Instead of integrating over the A mu in the functional integral, I integrate over the A tilde of mu, which that's the same as we integrate. So we just make a change of variables. But that's the right things we do when we do a calculation of an effective action. Remember the calculation we did for 5-4. Okay, and then I want to enforce a gauge condition on A tilde of mu, which is, we depend on A mu. For each given A underlying mu, any background field, I adjust the gauge condition. I'm free to choose a gauge condition on the gauge field. So I adjust the gauge condition such that it becomes d mu bar of a tilde mu equals zero, where this is just the covariant derivative with respect to the background field a mu. So this is in fact the original things, d mu of a mu tilde minus the I times the commutator of the background field a mu with a tilde mu. I think this is a better indices. You see? That's the general definition of a covariant derivative of some object in a gauge field A mu is the ordinary derivative minus I times the commutator of the gauge field with the field in the that's the usual definition of a covariant derivative. Remember that here a tilde mu belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2. Okay. Okay. So I'm choosing a gauge condition on the field I am integrating over, which depends on my initial choice of background field. This is going to be fixed in the calculation. Okay. And then, if you do that, of course, if I write A as a background field, classical part plus a fluctuation, out of that, so remember, I'm going to write this again, A is A background plus A quantum, that's in a very compact notation. Then you can compute what is the field strength of the original field as a function of the field strength of the background field and of the field strength of A tilde. And you find that this is just the F mu nu of the background field calculated in the standard way plus quantum part of F tilde mu nu, which is just F tilde mu nu equal, well, it's just d bar mu a nu tilde nu minus d bar nu a mu minus I, the commutator of a tilde mu with a tilde nu. You see, so you see this field strength of the quantum part of the field is just the same definition as the ordinary field strength. Simply, we have replaced the ordinary derivative d mu by the covariant derivative with respect to the field a mu. So this is a covariant derivative.
I have a question.
Background a mu. Yes. Yes.
Is that supposed to be an a tilde in the second potential you wrote in the definition of F tilde?
Yeah. So I define F tilde like that. Oh, yes. That's
a mu. Okay. Tilde. Yes. That answers my question. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Sorry. Okay. While, of course, F, the background a mu, is just the ordinary one, d mu a nu minus d nu a mu minus I a mu background a nu background. So that's the standard definition, and that's a definition modified. So F tilde mu nu depends on the choice of a mu, of a mu background. Okay, quantum part, and this is the background part. Okay, so this is just our manipulation. Okay. And once you have done that, you can rewrite the original action. So let's take an action which is integral 1 over 2g square trace of f mu nu plus 2 d mu a nu squared plus the gauge term 3 of c bar d mu d mu c minus I a mu c. That's the standard Young-Mills action for the original gauge field A here. So this is the action. This is the Landau-Feynman gauge fixing term, and this is the Gauss part. Okay. And I re-express it for a fixed A bar mu. Well, you get something simple. You get that this rewritten in terms of A bar, the background, and A tilde is just 1 over 2g squared trace. I'm using those compact notation because it makes things simpler. Well, f mu nu is replaced into this f underline f mu nu, so f background plus modified quantum. So it's going to be f mu nu plus f mu nu underscore underlined by f tilde mu nu, which is a function of a tilde. Remember, this f tilde mu nu is a function of a tilde squared. That's okay, so this becomes this. This term becomes plus two, the covariant derivative in the background field A underline mu, so D underline mu of A tilde mu squared. Okay. And plus trace of the Gauss field term becomes C bar D, the covariant derivative, the derivative in the covariant gauge field D underscore mu times the covariant derivative of C minus I A tilde mu C. So these terms, you make this decomposition, you turn the crank, you get this. So you see, what's the difference? The ordinary derivative becomes covariant derivative in the background field, and F becomes F background plus F tilde squared. Okay, so this is, I've just rewritten in this particular decomposition. Okay, so now this is a classical action expressed in terms of A bar of the background field and the quantum field, A tilde. And we integrate over this tilde, integrate. Okay, so now the trick is what is this? That's a bit strange. Oh no, I just have let's expand this section, expand it to order 2 in A tilde. Remember, this is a classical action. If we want to compute the effective action at one loop, we have to keep the second order term of the variation of the action when we make a small variation of the action. And in general, it's going to be written as the quantum term times some operator times a tilde. And we integrate over the a tilde, and then we get a functional determinant. Integrate over a tilde. And we are going to get the one loop term for the effective action. That's a formula we got in the lecture on the effective action at one loop. So it's a very general formula. Okay. So we start from that. And we go to the term of order that I'm denoting S2, which is just the term which contains two A tilde. Well, you turn the crank, and I'm not going to do the calculation because that's a bit lengthy. One has to be careful. And when I first did it, I made mistakes with the indices. You have to be okay. But you end with something which is simple. You get something which is 1/2 g squared. Well, you get integral over d4x, d g squared integral over d4x. You get the trace. This is a trace on 2x2 matrices. That this trace is with respect to the Lie algebra, okay, as usual. And what you get is you get a term which is a tilde and a term which is a tilde. And in between, you have a differential operator because you are differentiating an action which involves derivative. So you are going to get something which is like the Laplacian for something. Okay, so that's what you get for the B's, and you do the same for the C's. So I'm also going to keep only the term of order 2 in A and in the ghost. And in the ghost, that's quite easy because you just have to find to set A tilde to 0, because here you have an anti-ghost, here it's a ghost. So if you keep this term, it's of order 3 in the ghost. So this term is easy. So you get integral d4x. And you get trace of C bar D mu in the background field. So this is plus C, and that's it. D mu, then you get D mu bar, and you get C. So you get just the products of those two covariant derivatives. So this object depends on A underlying the background field. Okay, so this one is simple. You have just replaced, this has disappeared, and you just have replaced the ordinary derivative in perturbation theory by the covariant derivative in the background field. This term is a bit more complicated, and what you get, I'm going to write it in a very compact way. I'm going to write it as minus d underscore squared. That's the same thing than this. Plus two times an object that I'm calling f underscore. So that's the field strength of the background field, but expressed in a particular way. So you see, I'm going to explain what this is. But let's keep this because that's an important question. Okay.
François?
Yes?
What has happened with the term that would be like the background f mu squared?
The f mu nu underline squared doesn't vary when you vary a tilde. So it's just there. It's in the zero order term. Mm-hmm. I take these terms. I keep only the term which contains two A tilde. So of course, this term squared doesn't contain any A tilde.
And then the term in the ghost, that doesn't contain any A tildes, no?
In the ghost, there is no F mu nu. There are only covariant derivatives.
Yeah, but I mean the last term in the S2.
This one?
No, on the right hand side.
Yes.
That one doesn't find like any A tilde.
Any?
Any A tilde?
No, no. Because D mu is an operator which acts on something. So if you see, the D underscore mu is an operator which, when you apply it to some object in the adjoint representation of the field, it's just the ordinary derivative, it's just the ordinary derivative of this object minus I times the commutator of the background field, A mu, with the field.
Yeah, I mean that in the green box, there is one term that is of second order in A tilde, and one term that is of zero order in A tilde.
Okay, this one is second order in the C's and C bar. So in fact, what I say, expanded to order two in A tilde, C's and C bar.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's known that the ghost terms occurs at one loop. There is a way to represent the contribution at one loop which cancels the anomalous term if you don't pay attention to the correct way to gauge fix. So I'm integrating in A tilde, C and C bar. Okay. So, oh my God. No. I use the wrong blackboard. So this cannot move.
This cannot move.
This one. I cannot.
So the last one now has, because in the full covariant derivative, there are also A mu terms, but background A, right?
Yeah, because D mu is this formula.
Yeah, okay. I got it.
So when I have an object which is underlined, it's an object which depends only on the background field. Mm-hmm. But it depends in a non-trivial way on the background field. Okay, so I'm sorry, but I use the wrong blackboard, so I'm going to try to keep this. Anyway, so let's do that and use this hidden blackboard, but keep it there. So I just want to, where's my notes, to explain it. Okay, so this object, this minus d bar squared, it's an operator, it's just the same thing than this. So d bar squared, squared is just d bar mu times d bar mu, with d bar mu given by this. So simply, I apply this product of covariant derivative to the field A tilde. And then I multiply by A tilde and I get take the trace. So that's standard. This F bar is a bit more complicated because remember F is in fact is a anti-symmetric tensor in F mu nu. You have to pay attention to what it is. So in fact, F bar is a compact way. It's a notation to write that A tilde F bar A tilde is just a way to represent with a trace, more precisely. This is just a compact way to represent the trace of one half of F bar mu nu, I just put the indices, times the commutator of A tilde mu and A tilde nu. You see? So these are just quantum fields and this is a background field. So it's a compact way to represent this object. It comes out from the calculation, but it's better to represent it as some quadratic form applying between the A tilde mu and A tilde nu. Okay. And the reason to take this is because, in fact, if you think a bit more about what it is, A is a way to represent A mu A, where this is a group indices. This is an SU2 index. And this is a vector index. You see. So A represents an object which is both a group, an element of the Lie algebra group, and a spin one field. Okay. And representing this object as an F tilde is to represent this as some matrix of transformation which acts both on the SU2 index and on the vector index. So this element is in fact a way to represent an element of the adjoint representation. It's something which belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2. But in the spin one representation of the Lorentz group, O4 or the O31. This is the Lorentz group in Minkowskian signature, in Lorentzian signature, and that's O4 in Euclidean spacetime. So this object, in fact, since this object belongs both in the spin one field representation of the Lorentz group and to the adjoint representation of the gauge group, this is an object which acts on both representations together. Okay, but keep that as enough for the calculation. Okay. So now let's come back to this. Now integrate over the tilde. Integrate over the A tilde, the C's and the C bar. And you get one loop term of gamma of the background field of the effective action. But you integrate in a functional integral, integrate over the exponential of something which is a quadratic form. So what you get is that the effective action, or A tilde, is just the ordinary Young-Mills equation for A tilde. That's the classical term, which I wrote there, plus the one loop contribution. Well, here I integrate the Gaussian form. So I get just one half of the trace of the log of this functional determinant, minus d bar squared plus 2f bar. Okay, that's the results we got for the scalar field. And here, the A tilde and A tilde are bosons. They are vector bosons. They carry a spin, but they're still bosons. And then, of course, you get the contribution of the Gauss. So we get determinant, namely the trace, the log of d bar squared, but with a minus signs because of the Gauss. Okay. So we have a very compact way to write the one loop contribution to the full effective action. Okay, and that's the important formula.
We don't have a 1/2 for Gauss.
Why?
We don't have a 1/2 for the Gauss contribution.
You don't have a
1/2. It's like
no, because remember the if you have just one ghost and one anti-ghost, remember,
yeah.
You write dc bar dc exponential of minus a c bar c. This is just one minus a c bar c, and when you integrate, you get just a by the commutation.
Got it.
Absolutely. Things I've just normalized things in the book. Okay. So this is important result because in fact this is a compact way to represent the contribution of the Feynman diagrams at one loop. Those depends on d bar. You have d bars here and you have f bar. So they depends on the gauge field. So if you expand into gauge field, if you assume that you choose a background gauge A bar, which is small compared to a pure gauge, then you expand this in A bar, and you get the one loop Feynman diagrams. you know, expanding A bar at order 2, you get those diagrams, expand A bar at order 3, you get these diagrams, etc., etc. So in some sense, we have gained nothing. That's not true, because in fact, the nice property of the gauge fixing condition that I erase here, which is written here, is that from scratch, this is gauge invariant. That's an object on a classical gauge field, which is a background field. It means that if I change A bar mu into A bar mu plus d mu alpha minus I A bar mu alpha with alpha small, this is invariant. So let's call this A bar mu prime. It's just a classical gauge transformation, a local gauge transformation on a classical field. This is invariant. Okay. So by doing this, we are keeping track of the gauge invariant of the theory when we are quantized, at least at one loop. Okay, so now I have, okay. So now, of course, this contains the infrared, the short distance singularities. So that trace level operator, so when you compute them using Feynman diagrams, they contain the short distance divergence. This contains the ultraviolet singularity. Okay. But now there is, well, I only have, let's say, 15 minutes, and we started a bit late. So I won't explain at all how this works, but there is a method to study to study this determinant and how they diverge when you integrate over the high momenta. And this method is a very general method called the E-kernel method and the E-kernel expansion. And it's a it's technique which have been developed by mathematicians and by theoretical physicists, in particular Bryce DeWitt, when studying quantization of gauge theories and of quantum gravity, which has nothing to do with the fact that we are dealing with a quantum field theory. It's a mathematical technique to study object of a trace log or log of determinant of differential operator, which contains two derivatives plus some corrections. And basically, this tells us that there is a way to regularize that using the Heet kernel. And the result is that the ultraviolet divergences of this determinant, well, basically, this can be written in the following way. You can write this, you can write the log of an operator, let's call it delta, as the minus d over ds of delta minus s. It's a very general at s equals zero, where s is just a number. Now we can with the trace of this. Now trace of delta minus s You can write this as integral from 0 to infinity of dt, t to the power f minus 1, you divide by the gamma function of s, times exponential of minus t delta. So if I take the trace, this is an integral, and I have the trace of e minus t delta. So I have the trace of the exponential of an operator. But this is an operator here. This operator delta acts on functions. So you can write this as integral d4x and the matrix element between two position of space of e minus t delta. Okay, and this is a particular case of the matrix element between two points of the exponential of an operator, which is called the Heath kernel. Of an operator. Okay. And and the mathematicians have devised a way to study how this object behaves. And it's easy to see that if you have ultraviolet divergences, they are contained in what's happening when t goes to zero here. And one can show that this object, for particular operator like this one, behaves like 1 over t squared plus corrections, 1 over t. So this is a leading divergent term. This is sub-leading. And the leading sub-divergent terms correspond to some coefficient. Times, oh no, I'm sorry, that's one. That's something over the one. You have some, you have Ts minus one, you have some coefficients, and you have just a contribution of the curvature. Of the object which is in delta. And the curvature is there. You see, this is an operator which represents some kind of, propagation in the background of a gauge field. And if there were no gauge field, this would be just the ordinary Laplacian in space-time, which we know very well. This introduced some shift in the way the field propagates. And for small t, this is very local. So basically, the coefficient is proportional to trace the only coefficient which can appear here. It's trace of h squared with some coefficient. And this coefficient can be computed by purely, local functional method, no Feynman diagrams. You just study solution of the Heath equation with this Laplacian. Okay, so the general theory that states that you can only have a term which contains the coefficients, which is given by the theory, times the trace of S squared. But the trace of S squared is just the term which was in the original action. And you see that if you have just a constant here, you have dt over t, if s equals zero, in order to go to the divergence, you set s equals zero, you have dt over t, which gives a logarithmic divergence in the cutoff in t. So this tells you that the ultraviolet divergence are proportional to integral over d4x. So if you have a log of a regulator times some coefficient times the trace of f bar mu nu. And it's this theory of Heath kernel expansion which tells you that the log lambda divergence is proportional precisely to the term in the action. And if you do that, you did this calculation of the divergence, keeping always gauge invariance during the calculation. So that's a nice object. Okay. So you get a result, which is gauge invariant. And simply this coefficient, it's let's say C1 for the contribution of the A tilde, this determinant, and it's a C0 for the contribution of the ghosts. As you see here, you have a coefficient which is different there and there. And this, the gauge field are spin 1, and the ghosts have spin 0. Okay, so you get coefficient.
What we have written here is the log lambda coefficient of that first term, or
Yes.
Okay, but it's not like log lambda equals the coefficient of log lambda, right? What next slide? It was the expression below?
Yes.
Which is
yeah. This. It's just the idea of the calculation. You see, you end up with here is a calculation where you have dt, ts minus 1 times times some coefficient, and times f bar squared. Now, you see, for instance, and you had a gamma of s, 1 over gamma of s, which is a s. 1 over gamma of s for small s is 1 over s. So if you take the derivative of s, this with respect to s, you get something which is 1 over s. You get 1 over s, which is a pole at s equals 0. And the pole is the analog of the log lambda. So if you can work a bit more by stating, instead of putting 0, putting an epsilon here, then you get a log epsilon.
Okay.
For the same reason. So basically, this is a way to compute using mathematical method and not using any Feynman diagrams, the ultraviolet divergence. Okay, and so way to see is that the effective action for A bar is just integral of d4x f trace of f squared bar. That's the result at zero loop. So there is 1 over g squared plus a log lambda with some coefficient, which is well known, and then plus finite non-local terms, because that's just the ultraviolet divergence. And you see that you can re-express that into a 1 over 2 gr squared, where gr squared is the renormalized complete constant. Or if you prefer, you can replace it by your 1 over s. Okay. So you see that you can get rid of the divergence by a counter term in the coupling constant. Okay. So that's a very elegant way to make the calculation. And it applies to many other theories than just gauge theories. That's why it's important. Okay, so now I have 10 minutes, 5 minutes left. So I'm sorry, I'm going to be very fast, but well, the final result. So, gauge series. Since the relation between the bare coupling constant and the renormalized coupling constant, which is of the form 1 over g squared plus a counter term with the coefficients which are given by some specific calculations. So you have a coefficient C1 for a gauge field, and you have coefficient C0 for the ghosts. And the final result is that when you can write that the renormalized coupling constant is a bare coupling constant plus some coefficient with a term of order G0 4 That's if you expand the 1 over g, you get g0 force times cutoff, log of lambda, or 1 over s, or whatever, with a definite coefficient. Then you can define how the effective constant varies with the coupling constant by using these beta functions. Beta function definition will tell you how, when you change lambda, g has to be g0 has to vary in order to reabsorb the definition of gr. And you end up with the famous results of Toft, which can, of course, obtain by by computing Feynman diagrams, which is the famous beta function of the which is beta of g squared equal well, since we are in a g's dimensionless, this starts only at order 4, and you get up to factor 2, 1 over 4 pi squared times minus 11 divided by 3. So this comes out from this calculation of those coefficients. So it's just a given by the group theory structure of the theory, times something which is n for SUN. And that's it. If you have a pure gauge series. And in fact, this N has just a group theoretical origin. It's related to the the sum of the trace of the generator of the algebra. It's called the Casimir operator, the Casimir invariant of the group. Okay. So that's the result, the famous calculation first done by Toft. And it shows that the beta function of gauge series, now I can use this one. The beta function for gauge series, so the coupling constant g squared, has this shape. It's negative. It's different from phi 4, but this is positive. This is for youngness. Okay. And well, you have different ways to obtain these results. You have a way to understand it a bit, phenomenologically, but nothing beats the actual calculation. This can be viewed in the following way. In QED, the fact that the charge, g squared is alpha, it's the charge of the electron. It's related to the square of the charge of the electron. So the effect that in QED, the effective charge is screened at a large distance is related to the screening effect. The effective charge of the electrons becomes smaller at large distance and becomes very large at short distance. It comes from the fact that because of the pair of electron and positron created by the fluctuation of the vacuum, by the quantum effect, they screen the Coulomb force between two particles. So in Young-Mills, the fact that the beta function is negative is often described in terms of an anti-screening effect of the gauge field by itself. There is some phenomenological model to explain that. It explains, for instance, in the book by Peskin and Schroeder, based on a paper by Michael Dine and Thomas Appelquist and some other people. Okay, so there is an anti-screening effect, and it comes from the fact that Young Mills is a heavily non-linear theory. If you create a pair of electrons, the electric fields just add up in electromagnetism. If you have particles that create electric and magnetic fields, they interact in the complicated way because Young-Mills is a non-linear theory. Okay, so, and this has an important property which is stated that if you want to compute how the effective
charge
alpha equals g squared vary with the energy, you just have to integrate this equation. You have to write that the effective variation of alpha of E, the effective E constant of the gauge series. You just have to integrate the beta function of alpha effective of E, which is given by this, by minus this coefficient, let's call it B2, times alpha effective of E squared plus higher order terms. It's a minus and B2 is a coefficient which is positive. It's just some number. It's this number over there. This means that if you increase the energy, the variation of alpha decreases. So the higher E, smaller alpha effective of E, and you can easily integrate this equation by just keeping this term, and you get that alpha effective of E is alpha effective, the original effective that you started from, divided by 1 plus this coefficient B2 times alpha effective log of the energy, well, divided by the scale of energy you started from. So you see that the charge, the effective charge of particles in the Young-Mills theory decreases logarithmically with the energy. So it decreases slowly, but it decreases, really decreases. And that's, where did I put my, that's, this phenomenon is this is the phenomenon that I think you have, if you follow the lecture of the standard model, this is the phenomenon of asymptotic freedom. In Young-Mills theory, which has been crucial to explain, first, experimental results in high energy physics, and which is crucial for the consistency of Young-Mills theory. So you see that if the effective charge becomes smaller at high energy, it means that when you go higher and higher in energy for a theory with gauge fields, the smaller the charge is, so the smaller the coupling, and therefore the better you can rely on perturbation theory. And you know that in perturbation theory, the theory makes sense because it's renormalizable. So it ensures the ultraviolet safety of the theory. The theory makes sense at high energy. So it's good reason to expect that it's a well-defined, that you can define mathematically a gauge series as a continuum quantum field theory. Of course, most of the physicists are convinced by this argument. If you are a mathematician, you consider that it's not a proof. And in fact, if you there is some big Clay Prize or whatever, we say that if you can mathematically prove that a gauge theory exists, even a very simple one in 4 dimensions, you will $1 million, which is less than the breakthrough prize, but it is still quite good. And but that's the main argument, which in the 70s convinced the physicists, all a lot of high energy physicists were not believing in gauge theories because they said, oh, but they have a lot of technical problems, they cannot make sense. And they switched to gauge theories when this was discovered. And then this was the construction of the QCD theory for strong interaction. So this is a very important result. And finally, well, I'm done. Let's say that, well, let's just something. You see that if on the other side you go to low energy, you see that for a low enough energy, this numerator is going to diverge. It means that the effective coupling of E becomes large. So you can say, oh, but how can it make sense that a theory that we describe perturbatively by the interaction of gauge field, how can it make sense if the coupling becomes large? Well, the answer is that since it's a highly complicated nonlinear theory, at high energy, describing it in terms of its constituent, elementary constituent, which are the gauge bosons at small energy, is not a good description anymore. In fact, it means that the physics becomes non-perturbative. And there are other examples especially in condensed matter of model which have the same property of asymptotic freedom and which at low energy are not at all described by the elementary wave of the system, the excitation, which are called spin waves. So it's not at all a problem for the consistency of the theory. It's a problem for computing what is the physics of the theory at high energy. So it makes both life difficult for theorists, since physicists theoreticians are struggling with explaining, for example, phenomena like confinement. Works. Oh, there has been many theoretical progress, phenomenological theories, explanation involving, for instance, the instanton, and of course, a lot of now we have a lot of experimental results to compare with, etc. So it makes life difficult, but life interesting. Okay, so I hope I haven't presented any calculation, but I just try to show you, what are the tools which are important to study these problems of renormalization in gauge theories, and that this method of heat kernel expansion, in fact, is something that you are going, I think, to meet in other fields, because it was built initially both for gauge theories and quantum gravity, and it plays also a very important role in modern mathematics, which have nothing to do with physics, but which are related by the object they study. Okay, so thank you. Sorry for being too long for this last lecture. And well, I hope you'll be able to rest a bit next week, although you are supposed to both to work and to exercise. And I am still there next week, so if you want to pop up and have questions or just see me, you'll be welcome. And well, good continuation for this very good program. And I wish you the best for the year and your career. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for and thank you very much for being there, because I enjoy being there because of you.
Thank you, Francois, for a wonderful course. We're very glad that you could.
Okay. Thank you. And well, I have some lecture notes on the what I did in the last lectures, both instanton. On randomization group and this aspect of randomization of gauge series, I will put updated the lecture notes soon. But you have a lot of it already.